Can you speak Japanese?
Wakarimashita, George said.
I understand. Then he added,
You can't work on the fucking moon without learning some Japanese. I can understand it if you motoyukuri hanashite kudasai.
The soldiers may not have the time to speak slowly to you, Nobo said.
Look,
George said, looming over Nobo and Tamara like a glowering thunderhead.
I'm not going to sit here and bite my nails while Dan's got his neck on the chopping block. I may not be a fucking ninja, but I can fight.
Nobo glared back at the giant. Tamara suggested, What about the other team? The one that is following Kate Williams? Nobo said grudgingly, I could ask the team leader to take you with them. George grinned like a kid in a candy shop.
Thanks. You won't regret it.
He rushed to the hatch and ducked down below decks. Nobo shook his head. This is a mistake. George will be a drag on them. He'll make matters worse, not better.
Tamara slipped her arm around his waist and leaned her head against his shoulder.
You did the right thing. He wants to help Dan.
Silently, she added,
And he might have broken every bone in your body if you refused to allow him to go.
39. The underwater earthquake lasted only 72 seconds. Some of its impact on the sea above was absorbed by the soft mud of the seabed sediments. Still, a tremendous jolt of energy was imparted to the water. Monitoring satellite sensors detected a deep swell in the Gulf of Mexico, a spreading ring of waves like the ripples caused by dropping a pebble in a pond. But these waves contained megatons of energy. They were not high, so far away from land where the water was more than 2 miles deep, but they were spreading in all directions, racing across the face of the gulf, and steepening as they ran toward the shallower waters of the coast. The satellite automatically sent its data to the ground stations beneath its flight track. None of the automated equipment was programmed to recognize a tsunami. There had never been a tidal wave in the Gulf of Mexico within the history of the satellite monitoring system. No alarm bells rang. No human observer shouted out a warning. The data were entered in the monitoring system's computer files, where they would be analyzed someday. While the tsunami silently, relentlessly surged toward shore. Don Marcello Arcangelico found himself on the horns of a delicate dilemma. On the one hand, it was his policy never to allow himself to be physically connected with a crime of any sort. Other people committed the acts that he deemed necessary while he sat safely in his home, surrounded by witnesses. He had never been charged by the police with so much as a misdemeanor. On the other hand, he felt that he had to see this man Randolph with his own eyes. Gaetano was ambitious enough to cut his own deal with the big shots in the GEC. Randolph had to be silenced and the Scanwell woman neutralized. And Gaetano kept firmly in hand. Don Marcello could not rest easily on any of those counts until he saw Randolph with his own eyes. Trust did not come easily, not when the whole world was at stake. This was no time for a slip-up, no time to let Gaetano think that the old man was getting careless. So he commanded Gaetano to bring Randolph to his home in Reggio. There was little risk that Randolph would ever identify him as being involved in Scanwell's abduction. Randolph would be dead within hours. About an hour after the float plane took off, Dan whispered to Malik, We're not heading for Sardinia.
Are you certain?
Pointing at the placid sea and puffy cumulus clouds outside their circular window, Dan said, The sun rises in the east, and it's ahead of us on our left. Sardinia is a little west of south from where the yacht was anchored. If we were heading that way, the sun would be almost behind us. Malik unbuckled his safety strap and made his way forward to the flight deck, hunched over because of the plane's low ceiling. He spoke briefly with the two pilots and then returned to his seat.
Well, they told me to mind my own business.
Dan shook his head. It's not Sardinia.
What can we do?
Get some sleep, said Dan, cranking his chair back. He closed his eyes, but he was far too restless to sleep. He felt a sudden fatigue sapping at his strength. Maybe I really have radiation sickness, Dan thought.
I feel like a squeezed-out dish rag. And that damned earplug hurts. He knew there was a plane full of Yamagata paramilitary, following them at an extreme distance, guided by many satellites that Nobo had launched specifically to monitor the region. But what good is all this if they don't take either one of us to where Jane is? Gaetano had left the castle immediately after dinner. Up in her room, Jane heard a car crunching on the gravel driveway that circled the castle's inner courtyard. Going to the window, she saw a flash of headlights against the main gate, and then the car was heading down the switchbacks of the road cut into the cliff's face. Someone knocked at her door. From the barred window, Jane called out, "Who is it?"
"Me,"
came a muffled voice.
"Kim."
She let out a pent-up breath, suddenly aware that she was alone in a castle full of armed men, except for Kimberly.
"Come in,"
she called. The bolt slid back and the door creaked open. Jane caught a glimpse of the young man guarding the door, his dark face solemn, as Kimberly stepped into the room. She was still in the glittering blue sheath she had worn at dinner.
"Wow. They gave you the biggest bedroom in the place."
"I suppose they did," said Jane.
"But no TV."
Jane had not noticed until Kimberly mentioned it.
"I think Rafe would rather I didn't see any of the news broadcasts," she said flatly. "There's nothing much on anyway," said Kim,
moving slowly through the room, touching the sturdy old bureau, the faded mirror atop it, the massive hand-tooled armoire, the dusty, tasseled spread across the canopied bed.
"You're lonely,"
Jane said.
"Kind of."
"Are you really Rafe's fiancée? Has he proposed marriage to you?" Kimberly laughed brittlely.
"Marriage? Not for me. I'm never going to marry Rafe or any other man."
"Then..."
"Oh, he was kind of fun for a while. But I get the feeling he's just using me to make my sister sore."
"He's not a decent man." Kimberly shrugged.
"Who is?"
Jane went to the couch, sat down, and patted the cushion beside her.
"Come here and tell me about yourself. And your sister."
Luther Clay took his family to Biloxi for the weekend. As head of Louisiana's Environmental Protection Agency, Clay had phoned his opposite number in Mississippi to make certain that the beach at Biloxi was reasonably clean of oil and the Gulf water was all right for swimming. His daughter had whined and complained all through the long, sweltering Friday night drive. She wanted to be with her boyfriend, not stuck with her medieval parents. But as soon as they hit the beach early Saturday morning, she found that there were plenty of guys there who were quickly attracted to her. Clay fretted about the amount of skin she was exposing in her bikini. Even black skin was no protection these days. But his wife told him that it was better than her spending the weekend with that white trash she thought she was in love with. It was a hazy, cloudy day. The sun seemed pale and too weak to harm anyone despite the warnings about skin cancer. The tide seemed to be out farther than Clay had ever seen it before. Tides around the Gulf were never that big to begin with, but this morning it seemed as if the water had just picked up and walked away. Wet, gray sand stretched out for what looked like a mile or more. Clay stood staring at the uncovered beach, the tiniest hint of a worrisome thought nagging at the back of his mind. He saw his daughter laughing and horsing around with a bunch of boys, some of them white. Then he noticed something really odd. Far out on the horizon, the sea seemed to rise up, like a wall of water just lifting up, its top edge as straight as the horizon itself. Clay thought his eyes were playing tricks on him. He had never seen a tidal wave before.
"So you are Dan Randolph," said Don Marcello.
Dan looked down at the corpulent old man in the wheelchair. There was a smell of corruption about him, a stink of fear in the way the other men in the room walked on tiptoe and spoke in whispers. Even Gaetano seemed subdued in this darkened, dusty, closed-in chamber with its heavy ancient furniture and its lone feeble lamp casting more shadow than light. It was high noon outside, but in this room there was no sunlight, no time. Like a gambling casino, thought Dan. He and Malik had indeed been strip-searched and walked through an X-ray metal detector identical to the type used at airports. Now they stood in the gloomy study of Don Marcello's dream.